First and foremost, I'd just be remiss. It is January 6th. It's a three-year anniversary, of course, of the insurrection at the Capitol and all that comes along with it. And that obviously, that day playing a large role still, not only in our political day-to-day. You had President Biden with a big speech yesterday near Valley Forge talking about it, but it is playing a part in our legal world still through multiple court cases. I mean, dozens and hundreds of cases of people that were at the Capitol who have been arrested, charged, and many of them convicted. You have an upcoming trial of President Trump that has a lot to do with January 6th. And now we have people and organizations, whether it's the Secretary of State in Maine or the Supreme Court in Colorado, taking Trump off the ballot in part of what happened on January 6th. So it's, Karen, very much still a part of our political and legal discourse these days.
It is. And this whole use of the 14th Amendment to try to remove Trump from the ballot is a very interesting one. Whether you kind of put politics aside here, this is a little known provision of the 14th Amendment. And frankly, as much commentary as I've done over 30 years of doing this, I've never read this part of the 14th Amendment, which says that if somebody who holds office has engaged in insurrection or rebellion, he can be barred from holding office. And they, several states are trying to keep him off. Colorado's court ruled that he will be off. That's on hold pending appeal. And in Maine, the Secretary of State deemed him unfit to be in office under the 14th Amendment. And as we all know, that all those issues are going to be before the U.S. Supreme Court, who will ultimately decide whether those are valid things that were done.
And I'm glad they're taking up the case because obviously secretaries of states have power to determine, are they 35 years old? That's another constitutional requirement, right? Are they a naturalized citizen of this country, right? So you make those determinations. This insurrection one is way more nebulous. They wrote this without really a mechanism to who determines if someone is committed insurrection or help those that committed insurrection, right, Karen? I mean, that's what leaves us up in the air, right?
That's exactly right. Here are the problems. What is insurrection?
Right.
What is rebellion? There's no definition, right? Who decides what that is? Is it a court, like happened in Colorado? Is it the executive branch, like it happened in Maine? Or does Congress have to do it? And what's the burden of proof? Is it beyond a reasonable doubt? Does an impeachment acquittal mean that he didn't engage in insurrection? All of those questions are unanswered, and the Supreme Court is going to really have to address them. And frankly, you know, I don't envy them because no matter which way this goes, it's going to be very unpopular with half of our country. If he's removed from the ballot and this is affirmed in these states and all the states have a domino effect and start keeping him off the ballot, people are going to go crazy. And likewise, if that is, the Supreme Court says that, no, you can't keep them off the ballot. There's going to be millions of people who don't like that ruling and call out politics.
Yeah, it is definitely the biggest case in presidential politics since Bush v. Gore, without a doubt. And I wonder if the Supreme Court will take a similar approach in that in Bush v. Gore, they made it very clear when they stopped the Florida recount that this was a case decided just on the specific moment of Bush v. Gore. Do not take broader implications and inferences from that. Karen, I imagine the Supreme Court is going to want to tailor a decision that is very specific to the time and not try and broaden it out too widely.
Agreed. However, you know, people ask me all the time, Supreme Court likes to say that it is not political. The Supreme Court is political. Everybody who sits on a court in any place, in any state, on any level, comes to the bench with preconceived notions, a certain background, a certain political bent, a view on abortion, a view on all of these really important issues in our nation. And, you know, when you come to the bench with that, and again, there's nothing wrong with it, these are thinking people, you know, it could skew that result accordingly. And, you know, as you know, our Supreme Court is very conservative right now. And so, you know, you like to think they're going to methodically apply the law and do their best job. And I hope they do. But again, you can't discount the idea that there might be some politics going on.
Karen, do you think there's a procedural out or something like that for the Supreme Court so it doesn't have to substantively decide one way or the other?
Like, they don't have to decide whether he's an insurrectionist
yes,
or not, you're saying.
Exactly.
Right?
Oh, yeah. And I'm not sure that they could. I think what they might do is say something like, you can't have a Secretary of State make that determination. You can't even have a court. Maybe they're going to rule that the Congress has to make that determination, or that the Congress had to promulgate rules and a roadmap on how this would be done, and that because there are none, you know, this can't be used. You know, I really do think they're going to address it on a technicality rather than on the merits of whether or not this was an insurrection or that Trump engaged in it.
Right, because we are also in the middle of all these other cases. So if the Supreme Court were to say Trump engaged in insurrection, I mean, that could impact other court cases that he has coming up against him. Really quickly, Karen, I want to mention the 224. I'm just curious, has Trump been found guilty of any of these charges, or was he even charged with insurrection? No, and he's not been charged with insurrection. He's been charged with other things relating to January 6th or specific elector schemes in Georgia. But insurrection is not one of the charges, although the amendment doesn't say you have to be charged with the crime. Jefferson Davis was never found guilty or charged with insurrection, Karen, but it was widely known that he couldn't run for anything after the Civil War. So this was a nebulous article added to the 14th Amendment, which has broad other implications. And I really wish that the folks that wrote this and put it into perspective would have given us a little bit more thought on what they were thinking here.
Well, the Founding Fathers did a really good job all in. I mean, you know, frankly, our Constitution has really survived in such a great way, I think. But you're right, this was probably just having to deal with keeping Confederates out of office, and they didn't think down the line that we'd have a situation like we have right now.
Yeah, for sure. Patrick, any other questions on that front?
No.
Okay.
Can I move on? Yeah, you can. Go ahead, John.
We're getting a lot of great texts about it. Someone says that they love Karen, but they don't think that they should pass this to the Congress at all. It specifically says right in the Constitution, if you're an insurrection or cause one, you're not eligible to run for office. It's black and white. I appreciate the text 6-3-0. I don't think it is black and white. Even if you think, like, I think a lot of people think President Trump caused an insurrection or certainly fueled the flames of it. But it isn't quite as clear who ultimately makes that decision. And on the flip side, you want individuals making some have argued that, oh, maybe President Biden has committed insurrection because of his open borders policy. I'm just saying that's what some people have said. Do you want secretaries of state to start throwing Joe Biden off the ballot for that, Karen? I mean, I'm not asking you if you want that.
Process.
Right.
You know, there has to be some due process here. And again, I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump, but I do think that if we're going to just say some Secretary of State from some random state gets to say that was an insurrection and he's guilty of it off the ballot, that's giving too much power to someone without any process, without any, testimony or any kind of judgment being made. And that's just too much. And I don't know what the remedy is, but that doesn't seem like the right thing to do.
Do you think that, I love how I said I was going to move on, and now I have another follow-up question. Do you think that our Chief Justice Roberts will do his best to kind of come up with consensus? I mean, a 6-3 conservative opinion is one that will just fuel the flames of the Supreme Court doesn't have quote-unquote legitimacy. I imagine a 9-0 ruling on a technicality would be way better for Roberts and the court than a split decision.
I think that's a very astute observation. I think that Roberts is going to make a big deal about telling his justices that this has to be a unanimous decision, that everyone has to get behind it, despite their differences in political views, because this country could go up for grabs one way or the other. I mean, I don't see how a decision in this case is ever going to be palatable for everybody here in this country. I mean, half of this country is going to be outraged.
Yeah. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, I was going to say, Chief Justice Roberts has been, you know, good at that in the past. However, recently he has not gaining consensus for some sort of, unanimous decision. I'm not sure that's possible given, you know, the folks on the far right of the court. I mean, we'll see. I do think it will be a technicality. They will not substantively rule that, you know, Trump engaged in insurrection, because if they do, that'll invite a lot more states than we already have now to do exactly what Colorado and Maine has already done, and he'll be kicked off the ballot. So there's just no way. There's no way they're going to substantively find that he engaged in insurrection.
I would agree. If I were reading the tea leaves, I would say this is a 7-2, 8-1, or 9-0 decision.
I agree.
that he can remain on the ballot, Karen?
You're asking me what my guess is?
Sure. I always feel bad putting people on the stuff. Patrick's asking
I am.
You.
Yeah, legal crystal ball. I'd say it's going to be a unanimous decision on a technicality, and it's going to say that that Trump remains on the ballot.
Right, I agree. Okay. Karen, I think there's going to be a unanimous decision, though, coming soon from the Supreme Court, ultimately, about presidential immunity. They didn't want to expediently hear the case that is, I mean, it's a little complicated, so let me just wind this back for people. The court case in D.C., which is slated to begin in March, President Trump is arguing that he has immunity basically from anything he did when he was president. The Supreme Court, Jack Smith wanted to rush that case to the Supreme Court to make a quick decision. They said, no, pause, let's go through the normal process. Well, it is going through that process. It's in front of a D.C. appeals court next week. And the tea leaves show that they're going to rule that he does not have immunity from everything. And that'll go to the Supreme Court. Karen, I'd be shocked if that one wasn't a 9-0 decision that the president doesn't have the authority to do whatever the heck he wants when he's in office with no legal responsibility.
There's no precedent one way or the other. There's only a little precedent that doesn't really cover it. But in 1982, Nixon, there was an allegation that he was immune from civil suits, and that's one thing. But criminal is a whole other thing. You don't get out of jail card for free by being president. I don't think that argument is going anywhere. I think the real key here for Trump is he's going to kick the can down the road and try to delay the inevitable, which is the trial in that case. But I just don't see the court at all buying his argument whatsoever. There's no precedent for it. There's no constitutional language, and there's really no reason. If a president commits a crime, he should be punished like everyone else.
I think there's your 9-0 decision, John.
Yeah, we'll see. Yep. We'll see if it ends up being 9-0. But I ultimately think that's where it's going, although it could delay the start of that March trial. In fact, former Trump lawyers wrote amicus briefs to the D.C. appellate court arguing that if they were to rule in Trump's favor, then Joe Biden could order Trump executed under that interpretation and that he'd be immune from getting charged for it afterwards. Like, this is how ridiculous that is on the outside. I don't know if you read that, Karen. You were probably on the other side of the globe not reading that amicus
brief. Not sure I even understand what that means, but that just... I'm gonna cry. You know what? On that.
Me too.
That sounds good.
Makes no sense.
Karen, let's talk a little bit about your book before we let you go. Obviously, you and I have talked about, and you've talked a lot on this air on the airwaves about your time working with John Wayne Gacy. Obviously, an incredibly evil man who was executed years and years ago. The book. What's it all about?
Well, he was executed 30 years ago come this May, and I finally decided to write the book. I get asked to talk about my experience. I get asked to talk about the death penalty. I have never taken a death penalty case before or after, and we don't have a death penalty anymore in Illinois, as you know. And I just decided to write it. And now with, hindsight and looking, kind of looking at my career and looking at how this affected my career, it's more than just about representing Gacy. It's about kind of standing up against an issue that you feel strongly about as a young lawyer, how that changes the direction of your whole life, how as a woman I was treated very differently by the courts, by the press, and just kind of what it was like to look evil in the eye and deal with someone who was guilty of such horrific crimes. It's something that I hope readers will get something out of. I don't really like preach against the death penalty. I certainly tell you my arguments, but what I really want to get across is kind of something uplifting, which is taking on a challenge in your life and how when you do something like that, it can always, it can usually turn out to be a good thing.
Is the book all out and everything right now? Can people buy it or is it coming out soon?
It's out for pre-order on Amazon. It's called Killing Time with John Wayne Gacy, and it will be out in full in May, and hopefully I'm going to have some events, and if anyone wants to email me, I can put you on the list. I'm going to have some parties and launches and all that kind of stuff. WGN at askkarenconti.com.
If I pre-order it, will you sign it for me one day, Karen?
I absolutely will, John.
I love
that. For an additional $5.
I asked her the same question you said for $10 for me.
Oh, well,
that's good for you,
that's
John.
Good. I'll take that for sure. Karen, it was great to talk with you. Thanks for joining us, and welcome back from your trip.
See you Monday.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone.
That's right. That's Karen Conti, who does all the family law stuff. Patrick Dolan of the same firm, Conti and Dolan, does the employment law stuff.
I do.
We'll take a break. We got the news. What are we talking about? This is Let's Get Legal. This is powered by the Illinois State Bar Association.
Karen had some good thoughts.
Karen did, and the texters do too. I get everyone's inclination, not everyone, excuse me, people that don't like President Trump, their inclination to not want him on the ballot, who believe genuinely, I think, some people believe that he's an insurrectionist or fomented one, just recognize that there's obviously people that don't feel that way, and he hasn't been charged with that nor convicted of that, nor has the Congress impeached him for that. And I feel like there's a lot of people in the middle, too, and that's kind of where I sit, where it's like, I don't like the idea of any one person deciding who can or can't be on a ballot.
But we do have standards, though, under the Constitution, and if you don't meet those standards, you should not be eligible for office.
But the couple of the standards are very clear. 35 years old, born in this country.
I understand.
This insurrection one is not clear. It really isn't.
It's not as clear. It's not as clear. It could be. We'll see what the Supreme Court says. Unfortunately, they probably won't.
They will not. Exactly.
They won't define it for us. I'm
they
just saying.
Not. And nor should they, probably. I mean, ultimately, they need to make these decisions. I don't know. This is really hard. This is where America is hard, right? And Karen mentioned the founders did a great job with the Constitution. I would agree. But we have done hundreds of years of litigation on the First Amendment alone, right? Back and forth. This is what's beautiful about our country and our judicial system is that things that were written by quill and paper when muskets were the mode of weapon and there wasn't the internet, those still are binding constitutional principles because of 200 some years of the courts weighing these things.
I understand, but then now here's the Supreme Court's chance to define what insurrection is. And they could set the standard like these other things that you're talking about. And if you engage in that, you're ineligible for office. But I don't think they will.
They will.
And I think that's a problem. I think they should. I really do.
You think that the Supreme Court should say former President Trump is or isn't an insurrectionist, and here's our decision?
I think so, absolutely. Otherwise, we will again have a term that is not defined. We will not know what insurrection is for purposes of ineligibility for office.
Does it bother you in any sense that insurrection is a legal term? Calling someone an insurrectionist would imply a criminal, and he hasn't been tried by a jury of his peers for that. It's charged by a court.
I understand that, but, you know, the Supreme Court can set a standard that is not a criminal conviction that equates to insurrection. Otherwise, we will still not know what that means.
Right.
I agree. It's a struggle. It's a struggle, but we need that term defined.
I just, you know, for me, I'm just such a, like, you know, I'm pretty down the middle. I will lean certain different ways on different issues at times. But like at the end of the day, what my biggest goal is, and I think a lot of people are like this, let's just keep the republic. Let's keep this going in a way that it has been going. Agree or disagree. Let's get back to like normal politics where we disagree on policies, but we figure out ways to make it work, and there's times your candidate wins and you like it, and there's times that they don't, and you work with your team or your party to try and change things. I guess what I'm saying is like, I worry about them, the Supreme Court, saying he's ineligible on all these states. I don't think they're going to do this, and we all don't think they're going to do this, but like, I don't like the idea of like a Secretary of State having that power just to say, you're not eligible for this ballot, I'm sorry. It really eats at me as someone who just wants this republic to keep going.
I understand that, but it seems like we're beyond that now. No, I get that. But we need that term defined. If you engage in insurrection, you're ineligible for office. Supreme Court, tell us what that means. That's what I think. It's ironic. It's almost ironic that it's like could be anti-democratic in a way. That's what you're saying, right? Because you're keeping someone off the ballot. But at the same time, we have standards.
I know.
For folks who are supposed to be in office. I don't know. I get it, but I get frustrated. I get frustrated because to me, that is very clearly an act of insurrection.
Right. And when I think back to like the January 6th day 3 years ago, and I still feel this way. I mean, it was appalling to watch.
It was horrible.
It was scary. I cannot believe what happened that day. Still, I still can't believe it. And watching it was surreal, and it was wrong. And I consider that day in my mind an insurrection.
Right.
I do.
I think most people do.
And I think a lot of it was fomented by the former president. And so I'm not disagreeing with a lot of that. And a lot of texters are coming at me on that. I'm not making excuses for the former president in any way. My concern is like kind of taking it out from 30,000 feet about how this process should pay out. Maybe I'd be okay with if Colorado State Legislature voted to not have him on the ballot. If state legislatures did that, then at least the legislatures are beholden to the people who elected them in. That at some point you say, yes, the people and their representatives in each individual state have made this decision that he is not eligible for the ballot. That at least has some layer of people had a chance to weigh in on this.
So do you differentiate between the Secretary of State in Maine versus the Colorado Supreme Court as the decision maker?
Yes.
Is one better than the other?
Yes. I do think the Colorado Supreme Court has a stronger case in that it went through a judicial process that then can be appealed directly to the Supreme Court. I also do appreciate that the Maine Secretary of State immediately stayed her ruling, saying, this is what I feel like, but this should be appealed. And in fact, he will remain on the ballot until it's appealed. I respect that. And I also respect the fact that she, acting as she is, as the chief election judge or person in her state,
right,
that is her authority to determine who is eligible or not for the ballot.
No one else can do it.
No one else can do it. So she made that determination. Yeah. I respect it, and I'm glad that she stayed her own ruling and that this could go through an appeals process. I just think that the Supreme Court or someone needs to come up with a way. Maybe we need to get a constitutional convention together, all of us. We've never done that before. That's one mechanism in the Constitution we've never used. And we can figure out a few of these things. But let's at least make state legislatures the ones to vote on this, or the Congress or the Senate or whatever. And
it seems like this insurrection language is completely meaningless if we're not told what it means.
Fair.
That's my point.
Right. And maybe it is one of those things. It's like, was it Justice Potter? I believe he was talking about pornography. He said, quote, you know when you see it.
Right.
So it is that. You know it when you see it. But of course, that is great in a vacuum. But in a political world where people's motivations are to beat the other guy and one team beats the other team, you start setting standards that secretaries of states can make these decisions. Okay, well, guess what? It might have helped your team this time, but it's going to hurt your team
but
the next
somebody
time.
Somebody has to make that decision. Somebody has to make that decision. And we need to be told what it is.
224 chimed in with, the Constitution was written in a manner not to be easy. And to make changes based on how one may feel leading this country in a manner we don't want to see it, we become soft. And I don't know. This is hard.
It is.
We are in a really tough couple of years.
Yes.
Even if you are the biggest fan of President Trump, you will admit that it's been tough because there have been a lot of questions raised about what happened at the transfer of power in 2020, whether you agree or disagree on either side. And this is stretching us thin a little bit.
To your point, I think you just want the people to decide who's president. Is that what you're saying? You don't want anybody to come off the ballot because of a, quote, insurrectionist
or
activity.
I want, if he was charged with insurrection by Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice, and former President Trump was found guilty of insurrection, then that makes sense to me.
But that's not what the standard is.
It doesn't say what the standard is.
I know. And so what I'm saying is you cannot assume that's the standard.
I know I can't. I know. I'm trying to...
It seems like a high standard for purposes of interpreting the Constitution.
Well, I think I have just the right to determine what the standard is as anyone else, considering they didn't give us a standard.
Well, it's the Supreme Court's job to tell us what it is.
But they're not going to.
I know.
I guess maybe
back to that. We're talking in circles. They should, though. Otherwise, it's meaningless.
Yeah. Anyways, 312-981-7200. I'm getting a lot of texts. Patrick Dolan is an employment lawyer.
I still think about these issues.
No, 100%. And I'm glad we are. And it's January 6th. And this is on people's minds. So why not talk about it on a legal show, right?
Of course.
But I do want to get to listeners' questions and help them, too.
Right.
You know, I think there's a point where it's like, okay, enough radio host John and actual lawyer Patrick Dolan. I appreciate your opinions on this, but let's help our listeners.
Love
so 312-981-7200. You can chime in about anything. I'd love to hear your calls, especially if you have an employment law question.
That'd be great.
Patrick helps you out with non-competes, solicitations, whatever it may be. Maybe something squirrely is happening at the office. You feel like, there might have some legal recourse here. Let us know. 312-981-7200. We'll do more after this on WGN. Someone was wondering, you know, John, shouldn't the Supreme Court be able to define what an insurrection is? Yeah, okay, fine. If they come out and they are very clear about what is, what isn't, what can be used as that, what can't be, then that'd be fine because they're the high court and they make those decisions, agree or disagree. I just know they won't, so then I'm left in this, like, nebulous, like,
But do you think they should, though?
I don't know. That's a great question.
I mean, they interpret the Constitution all the time, right?
Think, yes.
To provide clarity for terms that were not clear.
Yes.
So why not?
I don't know. Let me marinate on that.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to think about that, because you're right. Why shouldn't the Supreme Court be the one to just come out and say...
They should be.
First and foremost, whether it was or not.
Absolutely.
And I think I would go back to my original thought of the idea being that they don't... A Supreme Court doesn't come forward and say, you're guilty of a crime, you're going to jail, when a criminal case hasn't been brought through the process. You know what I mean? Supreme Courts don't just come out and say, for unrelated situations, say, John Doe is... Oh, yeah, by the way, as we're deciding this general election thing, John Doe committed a crime. And then they, with one voice, they say that. That seems a little strange to me. They don't do that for other things. Why would they do that for this thing?
I think that's too narrowly. I think you focused the issue too narrowly. I think they need to define a term and to determine whether someone's eligible for office. That's what I think.
I think they need to define the mechanism in which it's done. If the 12th Amendment is written...
They can do that too.
If it's so nebulous and it says, if they commit an insurrection, I think the Supreme Court should say, oh, by the way, in order to enact the 12th Amendment or to trigger it, to lead people off the ballot... The state legislatures are the ones to decide, or Supreme Courts in individual states have those decisions, or it's up to the Secretary of State. Fine. Then you at least have the Supreme Court saying that that's the process. I don't think they need to tell us whether there was an insurrection or not, or whether he belongs on the ballot or not. I think they need to define and give us guidance on what the mechanism is to trigger that 12th Amendment. Does that make sense to you?
No, it does. And they may do exactly that. And by the time that gets done, it'll be too late. So the whole thing's going to be moot.
That's the world we live in.
I know, but still.
I wish they'd give us guidance, because that's what they do. They interpret the amendments to the Constitution.
That's what I'm saying.
So interpret what they originally thought. Have two people, and I'm sure they'll bring up reasonable arguments. They will cite the discussions that happened in the Senate and the House back in the 19th century about what they wanted and why the 12th Amendment was there. Come to a determination about what that the writers of that amendment initially felt like was the mechanism to bring about this, kicking someone off a ballot, and just define it a little bit better for us. Let's move on. Let's go to Rob.
Okay.
Rob's got an employment law question. I'm not done with this. We might revisit in the 2 o'clock hour.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure we get to help some listeners out too. Rob, how are you doing? Save us from ourselves. How are you doing, my friend?
You guys are bringing it back to Thanksgiving with the family banter. You know?
Thanks, Rob. Thank you very much. What do you got for us?
So, So recently, I missed about, I want to say 4 or 5 days of work due to an illness. And because of the procedure that I had done, I had, you know, essentially lost my voice and I wasn't able to go to work. Anyway, long story short, instead of just simply requesting a note, like, you know, most other employers that I've worked for, they're actually requesting my medical records.
Whoa. So they, did you just take, like, how many days off did you take?
Either 4 or 5. I want to say, we'll just go conservative estimate and say 5.
You took a week off.
Did you provide them with a note from your healthcare provider?
So I was, I normally would.
Sure.
I just had, you know, returned back to work a day ago. And, you know, my boss said, hey, you know, if you could provide us with, I thought she was going to say
a note,
you know, typical,
right.
you know, like any other employer that I've worked for. But they were requesting my chart, you know, like the online login.
Whoa.
Yeah, no.
Now I'm not saying that they're requesting the login for that.
Right.
Per se. But
they want you to screen grab the records and stuff.
Exactly. Which I'm not going to do.
No, you're not going to do that. And you shouldn't.
Can we back up for a second? An employer after what, Patrick? After three days?
Yeah.
Okay, after three days.
Typically so three, yeah. But
it seems weird.
No. It's well, they're asking for too much information. It's confidential. And, you know, so no, you don't need to do that. But at that, you know, after at that length of time being gone, you could be asked to support, you know, a healthcare provider note to support your absence, which you're willing to do. But you don't have to provide medical records.
Rob,
and I wouldn't.
Rob, did you say, oh, I'll just give you a note, and that was refuted? Maybe the person asking didn't quite know what they were asking for or needed.
Yes, I had said, yeah, I'd be happy to provide a note that shows that I was in their care, you know. And she goes, well, you may have to provide records. And I was taken aback by that.
And you didn't use short-term disability or anything like that?
Oh, no. Just no, I have oh, no,
that's weird.
Was it designated FMLA? I mean, it's not that long, but I'm not sure if there's any care needed afterwards. You know what? Honestly, it doesn't matter. You don't have to. You do not have to provide medical records. You know,
that's over my head. I'm not sure. You know, I'm a young guy. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no. You just you need to supply a note.
Yeah, just get a note, and if they push you any more on it, call
give me
Patrick.
A call.
Yeah.
Give me a call.
Patrick? Yeah, you know, it seems like they want the specifics on the condition and
no.
Why
never give your boss that.
That is bizarre.
Yeah,
so it is bizarre. Yeah. Well, I hope you're doing okay.
Rob, I'm doing all right.
You sound great. Yeah. Rob, the phone number for Patrick, if you want to write it down, I'll give it away, and Iridian can give it to you during the break, is 312-332-7800. 312-332-7800. Call Patrick if they push back anymore on this, because that's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and absolutely. I appreciate your time.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. You as well.
That's great stuff. 312-981-7200. The 708 wants to know, can an employer create a policy where they can change an employee's schedule 2 hours before start time? Change the locations, they change the time. Rather than 7 a.m. at one location, it got changed to 7 p.m. at a different location.
So they need to provide you with some sort of reasonable notice as to change in your schedule. What did they say at the beginning as to the time?
Can it create 2 hours before the start time? So my guess is at 5 a.m. they message in the morning saying,
right,
you're not starting at 7 a.m. in Woodridge, you're starting at 7 p.m. in LaGrange. I don't know, I'm making it up. But
yeah, no, that notice seems too short to me. But if there's some business necessity, they may be able to overcome that argument that there's not enough notice.
312-981-7200. Did I say the 14th Amendment a bunch of times? I think I meant the 12th.
You did say the 12th.
I did say it. I think I said 14th once. 847 is right. I was talking about the wrong amendment.
I thought you said the 12th.
Yeah, I might have. I'm trying to find more employer questions amongst the amazing texts that we got. We did get the jobs report number, Patrick, I wanted to mention yesterday, and it was better than expected again. More jobs created in December than had been forecasted. I will note that some of the previous months that had also been bigger than expected were revised downward. We've seen that a lot, actually, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics this past year. It's not a conspiracy, people. They revise it, and everyone gets it publicized all the time.
Yep.
But the revisions have been downward, still adding a lot of jobs in this country, but they have been less each month, almost every month, in the revisions. Point being overall, though, Patrick, a lot of people still finding work. The layoffs just are not coming like people thought they would.
No, and I will say anecdotally, in the past 3 or 4 months, we've seen a number of group layoffs. I haven't seen those real recently. Folks come to me all the time with separation agreements as part of a larger RIF, and they have an agreement that we have to walk through. But I haven't seen those big group layoffs in the past month or so.
Right, I do know that there are people that are losing their gigs, but the continuous jobs claims were also low again, around 200,000 across this country of people that were out of work looking for work, and the number of continuing claims still low. And to me, that means that, Patrick, that while people may lose their job, they're finding other jobs quickly.
Yeah, and again, anecdotally, we're doing just as many contract negotiations as separation agreement negotiations. So, I don't see a lot of folks who are really having a hard time looking for a job.
Okay. 312-332-7800 is Patrick's number. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We got another hour of Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We're going to argue like it's Thanksgiving next hour, too, on WGN. Now time for the news from the Northwestern Medicine News. Room. Patrick Dolan showed up today. Mike Leonard did not. But we should be nicer about it. He's a sweet guy, and he lost his voice, essentially.
Super nice guy.
And he'll be back.
Yeah.
He's often on this program.
We'll do it again.
We'll do it again. But Patrick Dolan got some extra time.
Grinch part two.
How we used it in the last hour was to have his partner, Karen Conti, on, and then him and I to argue about the 14th Amendment. Now I'm getting my amendments confused. Whether Trump is eligible for the ballot or not, or what the Supreme Court wants to do about that. 312-981-7200. A lot of great texts in there. I'm trying to respond to some of them as well. And feel free to call in, too. But we have some employment law questions. This from the 847. Hello, Patrick. I'm a government employee, non-union. I've worked for over 20 years. Good standing. That's okay. Great.
Yeah, that's great.
Good start.
So far, so good.
Can the employer not invite me? There's a bunch of questions. I'm going to go rattle these off, okay? Can the employer not invite me to work essential meetings and not provide necessary computer equipment to effectively do the job?
Generally, yes, but it depends on why.
Okay, we'll get to that in a minute.
Yes, we will.
But generally, if they don't give you the computer you think you need, that's okay. Nothing legally wrong.
Not just on that.
Okay. Can they change the position to reduced lesser responsibilities without informing me?
Same answer.
Okay. So they can, legally.
Yes.
Unless
we'll talk about it in a
second. Can they change the career path goals of the position midstream without informing me?
3 for 3.
Okay. Do they need to invite me to an annual performance meeting?
No. And I'll say annual reviews are not mandatory in Illinois. Now, of course, most employers do it for good reason. They should. And it's something that, you know, but it's not required under the law.
Okay. So generally speaking, it seems that, like, okay, they're just, you may not like the way they're treating you, but legally there's nothing you can do. Unless,
John. They were treating you differently because of some sort of protected status. You know, is it because of your age, your gender, your sexual orientation, a disability? You know, there's so many protected categories in Illinois. And so you have to ask, were others treated the same way? Why was it that your job was changed, your responsibilities were changed, you weren't invited to the meeting, or you weren't provided the equipment you need to do your job? So there's lots of things that you need to think about that relate to others who work around you, and if you're being treated differently. Mm. And if you are, why? The big question is why.
Yeah, I've got a follow-up question.
Okay.
And this relates to any of those classes of people that you talked about, okay, right? Sexual orientation, gender, age, race,
yep,
religion.
Yep.
And there's others too in Illinois.
A lot. Yes.
Disability, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. Is it easier for you, let's say you take on someone's case, mm-hmm, to prove age discrimination, to prove race discrimination, if you can identify a pattern in the workplace? First of all, answer that. Is it easier to prove if there's multiple cases of it?
Generally, yes.
Okay. Is it impossible to prove if this person is the only person from that class of people that has been treated differently? I guess what I'm saying is, let's say this person's over 40 and they're claiming age discrimination, but the workplace comes and says, well, we got a lot of people over 40. We haven't done the same thing too. Does that mean for sure that age discrimination isn't happening?
No. Okay. And that's a really good question. Okay. And, you know, there's actually some recent case law addressing that specific point. So it does not address the question of whether this individual has been the victim of discrimination if others in that same category have been treated better. People think it does. It's like, oh, but, you know, another person over 40 was treated better, or another female was treated the same way. No, we have to look at your individual circumstance and to determine whether you were the victim of discrimination or retaliation or harassment or something like that. So, you know, companies point to those things all the time. It does not answer the question whether discrimination occurred.
So it may help your case if you can show that a company routinely discriminates based on one of those factors.
Yes.
But it does not eliminate your case that it only happened to one person.
For sure. And to your first point, if there are different decision makers, then it may, frankly, not help your individual case. Like if this boss was not the same boss that treated other people, you know, in a discriminatory way, maybe it doesn't help my client. But systemically, if the employer isn't responding to these different claims of discrimination involving different bosses, et cetera, then you have a systemic issue that could support that individual's claim.
It's an interesting point you bring up, because I think we often say, like, did the employer act wrong? And we picture the boss or the superior.
Yeah.
But really, we're talking about companies that may support systemic discrimination in many different ways. And when you're issuing a lawsuit or writing a letter, you're not writing it to the boss of this one person. You're writing it to the employer.
I am. And it's either to the head of HR initially, or to the in-house lawyer, or to the president of the company, or the owner of the company. Are those sometimes the people engaged in the wrongdoing? Yes. So I try to send it to somebody else, frankly, because maybe that letter is going to get buried or something. But mm-hmm, you're talking about the company when we're talking about, you know, the boss's bad behavior.
Okay. We'll take a break here. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. 312-332-7800 is Patrick Dolan's phone number. Also Karen Conti's phone number, because you're Conti and Dolan.
Yes, we are.
And they're having an arm wrestling contest. Is that Monday or Tuesday?
Probably Monday morning, first thing.
Let me know who wins that.
No, I don't think I will.
Yeah,
but, okay.
We'll have to go to the sports betting sponsor we have to lay some odds on that.
We'll video. We'll put it up on
I'm
some social
Karen
media.
Karen at a -300.
Oh, geez.
To beat Patrick. Yeah,
God, that's tough.
Sorry, bud.
That's okay.
And you're as fit as a fiddle. Her biceps are huge.
Yeah, she does. You know, she's.
All right. Anyways, during this commercial break, we will arm wrestle. Then we'll answer your questions about employment law. 312-981-7200. After this on WGN. You've helped a lot of our listeners over the year or so that you've been with us. How does that process usually go? When I say call Patrick, 312-332-7800, what are you asking? What sorts of things do you do?
Yeah, so and a lot of people do follow up, and I really enjoy talking with them. So I have a conversation to get into further detail about what their issue is. For example, we had someone who asked about a public accommodation, an accommodation at their workplace for a parking place because they're disabled. So we talked about that.
Oh, right, because that was someone that said that the office space had the appropriate handicap spots in front of the office.
Yes.
But people in the back who worked in the factory, there were no spots available.
Yep.
And this person had indicated that they had asked and got nowhere, which seemed not fair.
Right. And so I provided them, you know, a lot of information to present to the employer. Sometimes I contact the employer directly. Sometimes I help them say, this is what you say. I'll help you write an email because you want it in writing. That's what we did. And then I think it worked out for them.
So the
process is either I get directly involved after a conversation with the employer, or I just help them communicate with the employer, whatever's the most effective thing to do.
How often does a letter work? A letter from Patrick Dolan.
It works pretty often. I think because, you know, a lot of employers, unfortunately, will just, you know, tell their HR person, see if they can work it out with this employee, and maybe it doesn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's taken more seriously by an employment lawyer, me or anybody else representing them, who can outline the claims, what's going to happen if we can't work it out. You know, this is where we go to file. Maybe it's an EEOC charge of discrimination. So the consequences of not working it out are brought to the forefront, which I think incentivizes employers to say, okay, let's deal with this issue now before it becomes bigger. And I think that's usually how it works best.
847 says, oh, this is the follow-up to the non-union government employee.
Okay.
Who had the series of questions. They added, it seems that only two of us were not invited to an annual performance meeting. 20 others were invited. Oh. That does seem like a problem.
Yeah, though. I would like to know why. You know, yes, that's exactly the kind of issue that I get into. You know, why not you? And then was there anybody else? One other person? Okay, what do you have in common with that person? What's really going on here?
Right, because as you told me during the break, no, there is no law that annual performance reviews are mandatory, that someone can demand and receive an annual performance review. But what gets squirrely is if there is discrimination or there's certain choices being made about who gets one and who doesn't. That could reveal something behind the scenes that's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you treat people differently, the question is why.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, 847, call Patrick, 312-332-7800, and then let us know how it goes. Texters, you can always tell me really how easy Patrick or Hardy is to work with. I always want to know. Give me the real dirt on Patrick Dolan.
Oh, man.
Let's go to the phone lines. Ron has an interesting question. Ron, what do you got for us today?
Yes. Hello, gentlemen. My question, with cannabis being legal, what about companies that require some form of drug test prior to, you know, employment? So thank you. Love the show.
Oh, thank you. That is such a great question.
It is.
Can they still ask for drug tests for most jobs for cannabis?
They can. Remember, it's still not legal federally, right?
Right.
And they can. Now, oftentimes, you know, it'll be a job-related drug test for cannabis, but companies can still, assuming they follow all the proper procedures to actually do the drug test, they can test for cannabis and they can, discipline or terminate someone for failing a drug test.
Before they're hired?
Yeah. Well, it has to be a conditional offer.
Okay.
At that point, yes. You have to have been offered conditionally a job and then engage in a drug test. Then if you fail, they can withdraw the offer. I was talking about someone who's just randomly drug tested while they're already employed.
So it's totally fine for a company to say, you can't use drugs.
Yes.
Can't use cannabis.
Yes.
off premises. You can't use cannabis.
If you test positive for cannabis, even though it's legal in the state of Illinois, it is still possible to discipline and terminate someone for failing a drug test.
Can they, what is the policy of drug, like, can you refuse a drug test? Like, how do they have to give you time? Do you happen to know the laws on, like, can they burn one on you last second?
Yeah. And it also depends on what you're doing, right? So a lot of issues related to, like, workers' comp, for example, and if there's an accident at work,
ooh, yeah,
then they can do that right away. They can randomly drug test with limited notice, but again, there's procedures they have to go through that are pretty strict about actually pulling someone off site and engaging in a drug test or just simply randomly drug testing. So it's not that it can happen like in the spur of the moment. Companies need to have a reasonable basis for doing it and follow a procedure.
269 was following up to a caller that we had in the last half hour about supplying medical records.
Okay.
If you weren't listening, someone took 5 days off of work, standard sick time. They lost their voice. They offered to provide a note, and the HR representative, I think, or the boss or someone said, oh, no, we need to – can you go on to log into my chart and give us medical records?
Yeah.
And someone followed up being like, whoever's asking that has no clue. A letter should be fine. No one should ever give up their medical records to anyone. I'd imagine that would be your argument, too, for basically anything employee-related, unless it has to do with FMLA, right?
Yeah, but then even there's limitations as to what needs to be provided for FMLA to support that leave. So when you're talking about medical records, those are things that almost never should go to your employer. But there are very limited circumstances under which records will be required, but that is truly the exception.
Yeah. What's FMLA again? We've mentioned that a couple times.
Yeah, so it's, you know, leave for you if you have a serious health condition or if you have someone in your family has a serious health condition. There's a process. You fill out some paperwork and you can be provided up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for your own or someone else's serious health condition.
And you're saying that even that, you may not necessarily need to turn over records. There's some paperwork, maybe a doctor's note or something,
yes,
that says this person cannot do this job for,
yes,
now or whatever,
yes,
it is.
Yes. There's forms that the physician will fill out, but in terms of medical records, no, they do not need to be provided.
We often get a lot of questions, and oh, I texted you this one about a friend of mine. I won't say who, but their wife had lost their job while they were on maternity leave.
Right.
Are companies allowed to fire you in the middle of maternity leave?
Well, they can, but there's a lot of questions that may actually conclude that it's illegal. But just because they are terminated during any sort of leave does not necessarily mean it was illegal. Now, chances are pretty good that it might have been, but there's a lot of questions you have to answer before you conclude that.
Do they have to pay you the rest of your maternity leave? Like, let's say you're using time off that you have from a company and you have 2 more months of maternity leave left. You're 1 month into it. They fire you. Do they still have to pay you out the rest of that maternity leave?
Well, assuming it's paid leave, remember.
Oh, they're going to accrue it anyways.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah. So it depends what the policy says if they're on paid maternity leave or if you're using like your vacation or something like that. But no, if they terminate you in the middle of your maternity leave, they don't have to pay you for the remainder of the leave. Now, I will tell you, that's fraught with peril, from an employee's standpoint. From an employer's standpoint, there's a lot of claims that an employee can make as to why that's illegal.
Yeah, you want to invite a letter from a lawyer.
Yeah.
Fire someone on maternity leave,
right,
and
exactly,
see what happens.
Yeah, or frankly, any kind of medical leave for mental or physical health reasons, not a good time to do it.
847 wants to know, this is a quick one here, if a job position was changed due to a consultant's study report, can we obtain the copy of a consultant's report?
No.
What if it was the government worker? I guess those reports might be FOIA'd. I don't know.
I might be able to get those as part of the litigation process. Demand letter, probably not. There's no obligation to provide me that information. And as an employee just asking, you're not going to get that information.
And generally speaking, if a consultant or any reason they change your job title, requirements, you know, whatever it may be, that for the most part, unless there's a specific reason why or a discriminatory reason why, companies and government can do that.
There's a lot of discretion to do that. I mean, right. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered as to whether that's illegal, but they do have the discretion to do that, yes.
All right, Patrick Dolan, can you stick around for another minute
sure.
or two? We'll go to the news here on WGN. Patrick Dolan, you don't mind sticking around, do you?
No, happy to do it.
We're getting some more questions about employment law that we might sure. have time for before the show wraps on up. All right, Patrick Dolan, you're still here.
I am.
I didn't mean that in a mean way. I meant that as
like, what are you doing?
I asked you to
around.
Stay because we have more questions coming in about employment law. No.
He's so interesting to listen to.
It's fascinating, yeah. And I'm someone who, and I've talked to the listeners about this, so they all know, most of them know, that I don't like flying. I do it.
I
do not let it stop me from doing it. I'm not someone that changes my life because of it, but it just generally am
uncomfortable. Right.
We just went back and forth to Philly. Both times, my watch thought I was getting a workout during the takeoff. It told me, you're earning zone minutes. Congratulations. Okay. Keep going. And I'm like, no, it's just because I'm nervous.
Right.
But I do it, right? And it's fine.
Yeah.
Because I'm also the person that reads about every single airline disaster and call Bob anytime we have one of these things. But that's why I did want to say at the end, if you're on the Kennedy or on the Stevenson, you're heading to the airport, I think you know this, probably. That ride is less safe than the ride you're about to take.
Yeah.
The most dangerous part about the flying out anywhere is the drive to the airport.
Yeah, for sure.
So be careful.
Yeah.
You're fine.
I agree. My son just landed in Miami, so I'm thankful you just said that.
Well, I scared Mary Vandeveld once, who is not worried. I also like tracking planes. I have an
so
app.
Do I. And FlightAware.
FlightAware. And I look at everything.
People make fun of me in my family because I FlightAware.
This is why we get along, Patrick.
Yeah.
But like if I know someone's in the air, even like a friend of a friend, I'll be like, ooh, what's their tail number? What's
me
their flight
too.
Number?
Me
Let me
too.
Follow them. And then I start telling people that, and they go, you're the weirdest human
no
I know.
No way.
Yeah, I know.
My daughter's boyfriend just flew back from Amman, Jordan. I'm like following the plane
the whole way. It went well.
14 hours.
I'll tell you a story during
really
the break
like
about
kind of
this.
Stuff.
More questions about employment law, 312-981-7200 after this. Patrick Dolan from Conti and Dolan Law. Here next to me, we were geeking out about our love of tracking not only flights of friends, but also our own flights.
Yeah.
And, I love the FlightAware and the flight app things, too, because Enrique and I, or my whole family, I'll get them involved if we're up at the cabin or if we're at my house having a fire in the backyard. When you see a plane overhead, I like to say, guess where it's going.
Right.
And
we do that, too.
There's like a prize for it. And I take it seriously because I start looking. I'm like, looking at the altitude. I'm looking at the direction. I'm like, that's definitely LaGuardia to Phoenix. And then it's like Dulles to Sacramento. You know, this is the stupidest game. I continue to reveal layers of the onion back for our listeners at WGN.
Oh, my God. You and I would just stand in the backyard looking at planes and doing that then. Because my kids don't like to do that like I do.
847 wants to know, did you track Santa's sleigh this year? I did not. I was busy. I was one time I was off the app.
Yeah.
Yep. Someone wanted to know, do you feel comfortable still sitting in an exit row or knowing that these doors... I do.
I always try to sit in the exit row.
It's a little more space.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Those doors are pretty heavy, though. I don't know. Maybe Karen would have to come and pull the door out for me.
They are always like, would you be able to assist in an emergency? I'm like, absolutely.
Sure.
As much as I'm scared about it,
the door's like 50 pounds, though.
I want to do something.
Right.
There's an emergency. I want to be involved in helping people out in some way. I think that's the only
control.
Way I can handle it.
Right.
And also, I just want to bring this up. Because we're talking about airline safety. The insane evacuation in less than 2 minutes of that Japanese airline.
It's incredible.
390 people.
I know.
They have done such a good job in airline safety across this world, especially in the Western world, about the idea, or anywhere really, that of evacuations from planes, the safety records. They learned so much from each of these crashes or incidents. The ability to get people off those planes when needed is insane. Because I think what makes it so amazing is that we can't do it when we land safely. Like, getting off the plane is the hardest thing to do. You sit there for 25 minutes if you're in the back row.
Right.
And then you look at a disaster, and clearly it's because they leave their luggage and they're just getting off.
Right.
But I do wonder, I'm like, can we speed up the normal evacuation, known as a safety landing?
And I know they've tried different things. It seems like nothing works. It still takes forever to get off the plane.
It sure does.
Anyway.
All right, I'm trying to find the text that we had about employment law. While I do that, remind people what you do.
So any workplace issue, you know, I have a lot of non-compete questions these days, John.
Really?
In Illinois, still enforceable under certain circumstances. Please do not assume that it's not enforceable if you have a non-compete. And we have to get into, you know, where you're going. Is it a competitor? What are you going to be doing there? How long is the non-compete? Most are 2 years, which is fine. Did you get any money for it? So there's a lot of, you know, questions about non-compete still, because they're still enforceable.
Mm-hmm. I found the text, by the way. Thank you for answering that.
Sure.
Good, Phil.
I was just going to keep talking.
Good job filling time. Yeah, thank you, Patrick.
Learn from you.
217, is it unlawful to treat a daytime worker differently than a nighttime worker with the same job description? So, like, it must be shift work.
Sure.
Similar jobs. There's one during the day. There's one at night. They're mandated to attend training that starts in the middle of the sleep schedule once per month. Would they have a case for additional compensation for hardships because of working at night? Or do they just have to suck it up because they didn't get hired for the daytime role?
Yeah, it's not necessarily illegal. I don't think there's anything. Yeah. It really depends when they say they're treated differently. I don't know what that means. If it's compensation, maybe, then it could be, you know, something related to a protected category. Any kind of term or condition, though, you know, could be, but it would have to be based on something like a discrimination claim. So just inherently, no, I don't think that's illegal.
So, for instance, if there's a day shift and there's a night shift, they can pay them the same. That's up to the company's discretion. There's nothing in recorded law that requires people that work harder shifts to get more money. Now, companies may use that to incentivize.
I was just going to say, oftentimes they are paid differently for night versus day shifts.
I did it overnight.
Which is fine.
I did it overnight for like 5 months. It was hard.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah, I was lucky. And look, a lot of people in the news and radio business, those morning show folks get there so early, especially on the TV side, that shows start at 4:30 or 4 o'clock.
Right.
Those writers, there's writers that work midnight to 8 a.m. We see it when we go over to News Nation, right?
Yes, we do.
We're getting there in the morning show and people are finally off their job. It is so tough.
I honestly couldn't do that. It's super hard.
Did it for 5 months and I only...
Did you feel good?
You know, actually, so here's... Okay. I filled in as a traffic reporter here at WGN. I was a traffic reporter. That's how I started here.
Okay.
And I filled in, and this is why I love Steve and Johnny, who, by the way, are celebrating the one-year anniversary of this new version of the show that they do on Saturday nights. They're celebrating it tonight. It'll be a great listen when it's on at 9 o'clock, I believe. Maybe a little bit later than that tonight. I'll check. But... I did overnight traffic for Steve and Johnny, and I did it for like a whole summer. Their normal traffic guy was out for a bit, and I was filling in for 3 months. So I worked at 10 p.m. to 5 a.m., essentially, or 6 a.m., and I loved it.
You did?
It was the summer.
Okay.
So I came home. I would go to bed right away. I'd wake up at 2 p.m. I'd have from 2 p.m. till 8 p.m. with sunshine.
Yeah.
It was the summer. I'd go to the beach because I had all day free.
Yeah.
I did it then in the winter. Not Stephen John. I did another job over the winter. It was the worst experience ever.
I believe it.
Because I'd go home. I'd get home at 6 or 7 a.m. I'd sleep till 2 or 3. I'd be awake for 1 hour of the daylight.
And it, yeah.
Couldn't
if
do
you're
it.
Lucky. Although, we haven't seen the sun recently, John.
No, we have not.
Yeah.
A couple days ago. 779 says, John, don't watch the new Netflix Society of Snow about the Uruguayan team that crashed in the Andes.
Oh, I saw that.
I saw Alive, the original one.
So did I.
So,
you know what? My wife just said, let's watch it. I'm like, you know what? Didn't we just watch that?
No.
You know, the Alive thing? I don't want to go through that again.
Yeah. I'm terrible because here's the thing. The moment that plane lands, so I put myself on an embargo from reading about, you know, plane crashes for like the couple of weeks before I get on a plane.
Yeah.
But then when I get home, it's like the best thing because then I'm like, oh, I can rewatch all those Smithsonian documentaries.
Because you made it.
I can watch the Mayday videos that I am fascinated by. But it is this fascination with that macabre topic.
Do you think something's going to happen? Is that why?
No.
You're just inherently uncomfortable with it.
I like true crime stuff, too, and that's scary, right? I've always been interested in that sort of stuff.
No. I mean, crashes. What you're playing. What makes you just...
No, because I know the math is on my side.
Yes, it is.
I know the safety's on my side. It's just this uncomfortableness of act is. And you know what's weird is, Patrick? We're veering off the law topic here, but that's okay. We're at the end of the show. Is that when I, growing up, I was so lucky to be, we'd go fishing and we'd take these little the planes that land on water.
Oh.
And those are bumpy as can be, five-seaters, me, my dad, a pilot, and my brothers sitting on buckets, like no safety video or anything, right? But you can see the pilot, and you can see their eyes. I have always advocated, the pilots would never go for this, there should be a camera that I could access of the cockpit. Because if I could just see that the pilots were super chill, it would make me feel so easy.
And you know that they are, though.
I know that they are. I know that
you just want to see.
And I look
it.
At the flight attendants when it gets bumpy, and I see that they're super chill.
Yeah.
But there's nothing like.
Until they're told to sit down.
Right. But if I could see the look in the pilot's eyes as they're just sitting there, like, we're good.
Yeah.
Of course, that would be really fearful if I looked and there was chaos.
Or they're not paying attention.
Or they're not paying attention. Yeah, no, I recognize that my fear of flying is,
But
a lot of people have it.
A lot of people have it.
And I don't let it define my life. We got to go somewhere.
Yeah,
we're flying.
Good.
It's fine.
Good.
No big deal.
Yeah.
And then I just am so worried. We have a lot of texts about, you know, this idea of people having employers asking for medical records.
Okay.
For just sick days.
Yeah.
And people wondering if that's a HIPAA violation.
It certainly could be, yes.
Right. And
yes.
HIPAA applies to you giving up your medical records, right?
Yep. Yeah. No, and you know, just to be clear, you need typically to provide a doctor's note for leave greater than 3 days, but not medical records.
Right.
We're not talking about some, you know, disability related lawsuit. We're talking about a time away from your job for a few days for medical leave.
And a doctor writes a note, that's a note. That's it.
That should be enough, yes.
Right. Now their handwriting can be a little off sometimes. Maybe that was the problem. Someone handed in a doctor's note and the handwriting wasn't good and they said, yeah, just show us through my chart.
Then why does the employer need that?
I don't know.
Right.
Was it Rob? Rob, call back next week.
I want to know
what happened next.
I would too. Okay.
That doesn't seem crazy.
There
okay.
Go. Okay.
Got about a minute left, Patrick. What? How can people reach you? Why should they be reaching you?
So they can call me at 312-332-7800 or send me an email at pdolan@contidolanlaw.com, Karen Conti. And, you know, call with any kind of work-related issue, or Karen does family law-related stuff, and we're, you know, happy to help you. And a lot of people, it's in job changes these days. It's the beginning of the year. You know, hiring's ramping back up. And so I think a lot of folks are going to be involved in some hiring processes, and there could be some discrimination issues in terms of how those processes go.
Patrick, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks, John.
All right, that's going to do it for Let's Get Legal. You'll hear me next on Your Money Matters Monday at 6 o'clock. It'll be a Mesero Monday, and I'll be back next week here at 5 o'clock for Let's Get Legal. News coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.